Welcome to Amped Up, Utility Insights, Trends and Challenges. I'm your host, Melissa Parvis, CEO of Athena, a consultancy and workforce solutions provider operating in the power sector. In this podcast, we explore the changing landscape of US electric utilities with great minds and insightful conversations.
Hi everyone, this is Melissa Parvis and you're listening to Amped Up. In today's episode, we are going to dive into a very crucial topic, which is cybersecurity and the impact in the power industry. It is a subject that is more relevant than ever before as our infrastructure faces increasing threats. Today, we're focusing on the importance of critical infrastructure and the role that cybersecurity plays, particularly in this industry. I'm excited to welcome Payam Hajat, University Professor and Chief of Cybersecurity, Risk and Governance for the State of California. Payam brings a wealth of experience in cybersecurity and risk management for critical infrastructure. Thank you very much for being on the show. Payam, I'd love if you could introduce yourself and tell us a little bit more about what qualifies you to talk about this subject.
Hey everyone, my name is Payam Hajat. I'm the Chief of Cyber Risk and Governance for the State of California and University Professor, teach different cybersecurity and networking courses. I've been in this game for about 12, 13 years now. One of my very first jobs, I actually started going to prisons and doing pen testing, you know, walking through.
Oh my gosh.
We would have to have computers out there for the inmates to be able to rehabilitate. So when they get out, they have the ability to, you know, have some skill set back when they get released. But, you know, that was kind of my first job, being able to break into the prison industry's networks. I kind of did a wide variety of different things, from enterprise security to security operations center, being a SOC analyst. Shortly after that, I became the chief information security officer of a medium department, about 1,500 people, 3,000 endpoints, and a lot of SCADA and ICS system. I was the incident response manager, commander for all of California. Whenever an incident or breach does happen, it comes to me for the public entities. That includes the DMVs, the tax branches, that's Franchise Tax Board, EDD, the Department of Transportation, those public entities for the state of California, right? Had a little oversight over them. In addition to that, I do teach at a university. I teach the California State University, Sacramento, and at a junior college, American River College.
That was very interesting. I mean, I knew that you were a guru in this area, but I never knew like your whole history. That's really cool. At what point did you decide, you know what, I'm super passionate about cybersecurity?
I was never really going to go into cybersecurity. So I'm a kind of a try hard, especially during college. And so I didn't like the major I was taking. So I took a bunch of random other courses throughout my academic career. I was taking like 25, 30 units a semester at once. And so it wasn't the smartest, but like it was just me kind of discovering, figuring out what I wanted to do. I graduated with about 100 units more than what I needed to get my degree. Once I got out of college, I already had a job lined up, but I hated it. And I was trying to get out of it. And I was actually trying to get into law. Before my LSAT, I tore my ACL, meniscus, and MCL playing soccer the day before. And
man,
I didn't do so well on my LSAT, I'll be honest, the next day. Because I was like super, super on a lot of medications because I was in a lot of pain. I didn't like my job. And my dad kind of helped me talk to a couple people or his friends. It kind of brought me into a junior analyst role for a department. I had no idea what I was signing up for, and it was security. That's when I started doing some pen testing, and it's more of like a self-discovery. Oh, right, I get an assignment. I'm going to go play around, mess around, and you know, you kind of just grow and develop some of your skills and interest the more immersed you are in that field or in that environment, I guess.
Yeah.
So it was like an accident, to be honest. Like that was never my end goal.
So you said like 12 years, right?
12
Which,
years, yeah.
It's a long time, right? But at the same time, it sounds like you've done a lot with your career. Why you looking after all of these massive government agencies? I mean, how did you get to this point?
There's no such thing as luck. I think luck is more so being prepared at the right time. That's kind of like my definition, but more so I was developing my skill sets and being able to prove my credibility. I think that's the number one thing, almost any job, but like specifically for security, and that there's such a need and demand for it. Being able to show your credibility of your skill sets, your knowledge, how to approach things is really important. So from the very get-go, my number one goal wasn't to try to be super crazy about anything, but just to develop the foundations and develop my credibility and get as much exposure as I can. So when I was able to do something correctly to show my credibility and make sure that my name was on it, people knew who I was, get my name out there, and it showed my credibility in that sense. Be overloaded. You're in the beginning of your career. You want assignments, tasks, build up that resume so you, when you go up and talk to someone or ask for a new job, right? Mm-hmm. You can say, I worked on X, Y, and Z and see how great it is right now, right? And also, you have to be good at what you do. So that's kind of important. And that comes back to the credibility portion.
That's some awesome advice for anybody listening in the industry then. Payam, it's been awesome getting to know you and a bit about your background. I'd love if we could zoom out for a little moment and talk a little bit about why it's so crucial for the US government in particular to fund cybersecurity efforts, specifically for the power grid, for example.
Yeah, critical infrastructure is really important, and it's really important that the government funds it because it supports every other sector that's out there, whether it's healthcare, finance, transportation, national defense. Everything runs on critical infrastructure, and critical infrastructure is usually in the terms of industrial control systems, ICS systems, or SCADA systems.
Could you tell me more about maybe this infrastructure is super important, but like I've never known, for example, like a bad actor to done anything. I've never seen anything go wrong, but then it's also one of those things where if I don't see anything that's going wrong, that's probably a good thing, right? Like, does it really happen? Do people really like have bad actors in this scenario?
Yeah, so here's the thing. Like, a lot of these industrial control systems, they may use a computer screen or, you know, some type of small computer in the back end, but they have their own specific set of protocols. They're usually legacy systems that no one knows how to operate, and there's minimal security controls around them. Mm. And because there's such a huge impact in case like something, if something does happen to critical infrastructure, it's literally in the name critical, right? Let's just talk about like water filtration systems. All right. Mm. Water filtration system goes down, right? Now half the people in America can't drink water, clean water, and that's going to impact them severely. That's going to pose a significant risk to the health and safety of the public. We consider them terrorists because they're literally taking down something that's going to impact public citizens. You see a threat actor going for a hospital, we still consider that a terrorism act because, like, if they take down an energy grid, they're going to take down a hospital and they're going to kill millions of people that are, I don't know, however many people that are in the hospital. When it comes down to the critical infrastructure, it's not usually about money. It's more so about nation states or threat actors trying to do acts of terrorism. So if it was about money, there's easier ways to get money. Threat actors, I'll say this, they are very lazy. And they have everyone's information already out there. They can find it on the web. And they will try to do as little, hit as many people as possible by doing the least amount of work. So threat actors, usually you're going to see them send the same phishing campaign to about 100 million people. A handful of them are eventually going to bite, right? And how much effort did that take, right? They just sent an email and now they, you know, like they compromise a bunch of people's accounts or whatever, or username and passwords, by just sending out one email, right? Specifically countries that have call centers, they're specifically going for money as well. And they're asking to get gift cards or something like that, right? So when people actually target critical infrastructure, they're not going after money necessarily. They're specifically going for terrorism attacks.
Interesting.
Sometimes there is like some type of ransom associated to it, but usually there's like manual overdrives and there's usually other workarounds in terms of not having to go through a technology-based system.
Is it possible to actually know who the threat actor is usually, or is it just like anybody's guess?
To be honest, like at this point in the stage, not really.
Interesting.
It's very difficult because everyone shadows themselves. There's so much obfuscation. They're going to try to obfuscate where they're coming from, their IP addresses as much as possible. So the best way to actually be able to determine who that threat actor is probably understanding the malicious code that's written behind that malware that was used to compromise that critical infrastructure. And that specific malware, everyone has their own kind of like quote unquote signatures, and you can kind of tell where it came from by who wrote it because of they use this function versus this function or something like that. But like if you're trying to pinpoint where people are coming from based off of an IP, that's very difficult these days.
Interesting. From what you've seen in your experience on code that you've seen written and threat actors, are there like any themes within certain countries that you would hazard a guess might be more of an active threat actor than others?
I would say right now, definitely Russia, Korea, China. Well, I guess it depends on like whose perspective, right? If it's from US's perspective, they're going to say, you know, China, Russia, Korea, Iran. I mean, those are kind of like the most well-known, and that's where we see most of our threat actors coming from.
And how common are these threats?
They're always constant. Always. So every day, 24/7, there's always scanners going, they're pinging everything, trying to do some reconnaissance. So that's the one thing that there's different types of reconnaissance. There's active and passive. They're just trying to figure out, like, scan your network, scan your environment, being able to determine that. So the most important part of an attack, so there's like a attack chain, right? Like kind of like a life cycle of like the first step. The first step is to do the reconnaissance. The reconnaissance is probably going to take the most time, and it's kind of like the planning stage. Hey, where is that vulnerability that I can exploit and be successful?
There's a lot of testing being done internally by utilities on their own employees. They'll send their own phishing emails. They'll send their own emails with PDFs or whatever attached. And they're testing to see like where the weak links are. And I know that it feels for these utility workers like very invasive, as though they're being tested, because if they get like more than two or three like clicks on the wrong thing, then they'll get in trouble, you know, potentially even like, you know, serious consequences can occur, you know. So like, how do people tell when an email is not right, or when, you know, it's really hard to tell because they want to do their job, obviously, but at the same time, like, you know, how can you tell?
I think first off, those utility companies are doing the right thing. They have to do the testing. They have to do the human aspect, the employees. They're going to be your weakest point. They're going to be your biggest vulnerability, but they're also going to be your strongest security control. Mm-hmm. They're going to be your front, like barrier, right? From making sure like things don't get in, I guess, right? And so it's really important to have that security awareness and training for those employees, because they're going to be the most targeted because they're the most vulnerable and not knowledgeable in security aspects, right? They're doing the right thing. I think like from a company standpoint, you should be at least phishing your or doing phishing exercises minimum once a month. Be vigilant as possible and understanding your environment, right? Are you really supposed to be receiving coupons on your work email? I mean, like, come on. If we start introducing a little more AI technologies, like AI has been a huge impact on the phishing aspect of social engineering, and some of these phishing campaigns are so real. Usually you can tell by not clicking on a link, but opening up the email and looking at the actual sender. If you hover over the sender, it should tell you where that domain's coming from.
Okay.
Yeah. If you're too scared to even touch the email, if you're not knowledgeable, literally look at who sent it to you and reach out to them without, like, call them. Yeah, or just call them. straight up email or contact them and say, hey, was this email from you? Verify before you actually do anything. And that actually leads into a zero trust architecture, which is very more complex, which is don't trust anything, zero trust, always verify before trusting and deny everything by default.
Okay. So that brings the next question is, can you even open an email? Is that okay? Or is it clicking on the links that's bad? Or is it where does it begin and end to be safe and not safe?
To be honest, you can open up the email. There's nothing wrong with that. You have to, you know, open up the email, but like just be very careful of what you do next. First, obviously, like before you even open up the email, take a look at the title. Does the title look funky to you or not? What are they trying to convey and at what urgency? So what threat actors want to do is they want to use a human aspect. Like they want to manipulate the human aspect, whether it's going to look like something's coming from an authority, so from your boss or from a director, or they're going to come at you from an urgency standpoint saying, hey, you have to click on this right now. Otherwise, like, you're going to lose something or you're going to lose this deal, or they're just going to look at the environment where you're at. So in terms of, you know, right now we're getting closer to the holidays. There's going to be a lot of coupons for Amazon or coupons for Walmart or whatever it may be, right? A lot of your shopping websites, they're going to send spam, right? Come buy this thing at this shop, right, with the 30% off for your gifts for your nephew. They're going to try to manipulate the human aspect, like what's going on in your mind from a psychological standpoint.
So an email coming from, like, I don't know, an external sender that is company xyz.com that's just like, for example, hey, we're selling like Transformers, right?
Yeah.
We'd love to connect with you. Clicking on that and then replying, not going to have an issue. But if it's like from, I don't know, I'm just going to pick a random utility, your boss's name at excelenergy.com, but Excel is spelt wrong. And then it's like, hey, I need this report ASAP. Here's the link to the, I don't know, Google Sheets. I doubt they use Google Sheets, but as an example, right? Here's the link, click on this. That is something that is an absolute raging no. Okay,
the thing is, like, some like small details they're gonna really try, and specifically the sender, the sender email where it's coming from, they're either gonna put like something like two dots or use the number one instead of the letter L, right? They're gonna try to do super small swaps that like you're not going to realize if you're reading it fast. So they kind of trick you, whether it's in the sender's email or the link itself. They can just attach a link to a random word. So if you do hover over like a hyperlink, you should take the time to make sure that that link is an actual real link that makes sense, that you know where you're going to. Additionally, you have to take a look at common misspellings throughout the email itself. So look at the body of the text. Does this grammatically make sense? You'll see a lot of misspellings because a lot of these threat actors that are trying to use social engineering attacks and phishing campaigns, they're not, the English is not their first language.
Wait, so, I'm sorry. Not even with, like, we have ChatGPT right now that can write everything to make it look human. They can't even be bothered to, well, you said earlier they're very lazy. They can't even be bothered to check the grammar.
I mean, like, Now they can, but like usually there's a lot of grammar issues. And then more specifically, if you take a look at the spacing and the formatting, you can probably tell if something's been copied and pasted or if something's off, right? Once something is off and sends a red flag to you, I mean, that should be instant. Like, I gotta reach out to this person independently and just verify this is a legit email. Because I will say, most of the emails that I've seen is either like a punctuation issue or like a spacing and formatting issue. You can immediately tell that something's off.
Okay, yeah. Interesting. So then they've got the email. They think it's fishy. They're not really sure. What do they do with it? Can you actually do anything with it?
A company should have their own phishing reporting process. If they're a little more on the mature side, you can actually click a button and it'll like purge that specific phishing email, and it'll send a notification to the admins, the administrators. But if your company isn't as mature as that, they don't have their own phishing reporting process, I would just recommend deleting it. Creating a ticket to your IT and say, hey, there's this phishing email, and then just don't touch it or just delete it. That's one of the most important things that from a security standpoint, from a governance aspect, that when I try to have oversight over I have oversight over, like, I want to say 100, 120 entities. That's one of the things that I really try to focus on, is that ensuring that every entity has a security awareness and training program, and that they have a phishing standard that they're following through. If someone does receive a phishing email, how do they go about it, reporting it, and what kind of training are you providing them to making sure that they have that capability, the capacity to be able to detect that, those types of phishing emails?
So besides email, email sounds like the easy one, right, for these threat
actors.
That's
the easy one, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Besides email, what else is there?
If we're talking about utilities, something that happened back in Iran with Stuxnet. I don't know if you heard of what Stuxnet is. So
no.
Pretty much it was just malware on a USB drive. It was just dropped in front of a nuclear power plant, a centrifuge. Someone picked up the USB, plugged it in a computer, had malware, and it just like took down 90% of Iran's centrifuges.
No,
and
I did not know about this.
Yeah, no. This was a while ago. A while ago. And so that's another level of social engineering, right? They had the malware. I don't know if they're called power plants, but
yeah, it's a nuclear power plant, yeah.
Yeah, they literally dropped it there. Someone came in, it's like, oh, what's on this hard drive or USB?
Oh my
Let me
gosh.
Go plug it in. And then it just destroyed everything. Yeah, so.
Wow. That's
yeah, and
insane.
That's a piece of history.
So anything weird at all, anything that's out of the ordinary, even so much as you see a USB drive on the floor on campus or something at a utility, that's a no-touch.
I would definitely bring that into like your IT, and they should be able to open that in a safe environment to see what's on it. If I don't know if they should, I mean, even touch it if it's not theirs. Usually you'll have a tag on it. Most companies have like a white area where they have like a couple computers, a small network that's not connected to anything, very sandboxed, and they can open and run stuff without it affecting anything in virtual machines or something like that. So, you know, they can use something like that to see what's out there. As for other things, from a social engineering perspective, like walking into a facility, like shoulder surfing is one, right? You just walk behind someone.
No, that's huge. That's
you walk
huge
behind someone.
Yes,
yeah.
I see that a lot.
Or just walking behind someone, they open up a door and you just walk right behind them.
You
can pretend you
shoulder surfing.
No, okay, so shoulder surfing is more so you're working on a computer, right? And you walk behind someone while they're typing something important or something like that. You know, take a sneak peek, or they're typing in their password, right? You look over their shoulders. I don't remember exactly what it's called. I can't think of the top of my head where you just...
Tailgating is what I've always
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. No, it's called tailgating. Sorry. Thank you. It's tailgating. Tailgating, you just walk in right behind someone who badged in. And for those who are a little more vigilant and turn around and say, hey, you should badge in, someone can just like have a fake badge and, you know, say, all right, here, let me just... You open the door and I'll still badge in. It's not going to register anything. But thanks for holding the door open for me. There's ways around that for sure. And then also there's different devices out there. If you have a badge that can read the RFID tags on it and then copy those RFID tags and like export it onto like a card. And then now you have a badge to get into anywhere you want. So there's different like hacking techniques, I guess. Another one is like a keylogger. Very cautious about anything plugged into your computer that you're not aware of. If there's anything like randomly attached to your computer and you're not familiar with it, like you gotta be careful about that. You unplug it and take it to your IT shop because you don't know what it is. If your keyboard gets swapped out, or like what the heck's happening to my keyboard? This wasn't here when I got here, you know, just verify. Be very cautious about everything.
Besides the phishing, most of the things that can be done are actually in-person threat activities, We're talking child gating. We're talking shoulder surfing. We're talking attaching random like keyboard or like whatever USB to your computer. We're talking dropping
insider
a USB.
Threats. Yeah.
Yeah. We're talking dropping a USB in a place where they think someone might pick it up and put it into their computer, right?
Right.
So like, would it be like conspiracy theory, like crazy tinfoil hat of me to say that there might even be people working within utilities who are threat actors or like double agents?
There's insider threats and they're from nation states. They have a citizenship with the United States and they just get hired within the government and they go unrecognized and they just do reconnaissance for nation states.
We touched upon what the future holds in terms of AI. I actually really hate that word in a way because it's so like buzzy right now. Everyone's talking about AI.
AI's already been out there for such a long time. I mean, it's already embedded in a lot of security tools out there, like how firewalls operate, heuristics-based security. If we're talking about like large language models and Gen AI specifically, it's gonna increase a lot of fraud and spoofing. That's one big thing that we have to be careful of with Gen AI.
Gen AI, what is that?
Creating synthetic data. So for example, when you go on those recently Instagram and TikTok videos where you see a political figure like Donald Trump singing a SpongeBob song, you obviously know that's fake, right?
Yeah.
And how does that generate it? Yeah, it's using Gen AI. And it's considered synthetic data. It's fake. It's not real. And then you see a lot of different like celebrities, you know, singing different songs or saying weird things that don't feel right. So that's going to be a huge thing when it comes to authentication. Mm. So for example, you want to verify that your boss sent you an email, right? And you call your boss based off of like a phone number on that phishing email, right? You can use generative artificial intelligence to have someone sound like your boss and respond to you. That's how Gen AI is going to like truly impact, I mean, from an authentication standpoint and spoof and fraudulent standpoint, that's how it may impact. That can lead to financial and medical fraud as well down the road.
Wow. You know, I heard about this. I heard about, I don't know whether it was a governor or a senator. It was someone fairly like high up in the government in the US who received a Gen AI call from what he thought was his son, who was crying on the phone and saying, "Hey, I really need help. I need money. I'm going to jail, whatever. Can you send me $1,000? Can you," or whatever. It was like a reasonable amount of money.
Right.
And he did it. And then it was a scam. And he was like, this was like 6 months ago as well, so we weren't quite as advanced as we are today. But how, like, obviously that happened to him because he's a public figure and somebody knew that he had money, right?
Right.
But how far away are we from that happening to, like, you know, nobodies like me, for example?
It's already happening, whether we like it or not. It might not be used as much, but it's just going to grow. I'm just talking about the bad. I mean, there's a lot of good that can come out of it, like lots of good services that we can utilize Gen AI. I think the biggest thing is that we just have to make sure we go back to more of a, like I mentioned, zero trust. Verify before you trust anything. If something's generated or a decision is made, that someone in the back end is checking to verify that this is actually real or not.
Mm.
Now, you're not going to be able to get 100% of everything that goes through. Some things eventually, you know, may pass, slip by. Nothing's 100% certain, but making sure at least that we do our due diligence and then we verify after artificial intelligence makes a decision or creates an output that, you know, it is not hallucinating. That's what we call it whenever a model is potentially poisoned or has bad data, it starts creating biases or false decisions. We call it hallucinations, right? And so to prevent hallucinations and for them to actually being applied, that there's someone in the back end verifying that decision before it gets applied to whatever, you know, you're using that AI to.
That's something we talked a bit off camera about that I thought was really interesting, Payam, is, and I'd love if we could like discuss it a little bit more on the show about how LLMs are being used to create decisions, but those decisions could have some inherent bias. Could we talk a little bit more about that? That would be interesting, I think.
Yeah. So, like, I'm going to first start off with more so if we're talking about threat actors specifically, they're going to use LLMs more so on the reconnaissance phase, right? Before they want to attack anyone, they're going to try to understand your environment, understand you as much as possible. They're going to put most of their efforts and resources in the reconnaissance phase. LLMs have made it super easy to do all that. There's a lot of information that you can pull from OSINT, which is open source intelligence. Going on Google, going on your webpage, there's a lot of information you can pull from there. And, you know, some LLMs can kind of summarize that all up into a summary and be able to profile you. And then in addition to that, if there's like there's the ability to do scanning, right? The next thing that you can do is scan your environment. Even though they might not be able to get into it, they can add, there's ways to understand what technologies you're using. So if once they understand that, they can then go back, look up the manuals of how to operate those specific technologies. Yeah.
What do you mean by that? Like, so you're talking like, you know, my Facebook app on my phone, or what are you referring to?
If we're talking about specifically about critical infrastructure, okay. Right? The different OT technology that's being used, SCADA or ICS systems, or even any type of technology, like understanding your firewall, right? They can just ping it or something like that, be able to determine what type it is, what version it is, what operating system it has. And then they can take that information back and look. There's white papers, there's manuals that they can look at and submit it through some type of LLM and be able to kind of profile and scope down, summarize, understand where the weak points of that specific system technology is at. For example, it can go through all the white paper of a specific system that it identified, understand, for example, what the admin passwords are or default passwords are, or understand the different protocols that are used that you may not be aware of. And then there might be a vulnerable protocol out there that they can leverage and exploit for a attack, right? Mm-hmm. Cyber attack. So it's more used as a tool to do reconnaissance more so if we're talking about specific cyber attack.
So I was under the impression, and I know very little, compared to you on this subject. Yeah. You are the guru. I was under the impression that LLMs or AI in general can be used to just constantly try and penetrate over and over and over, like what a human would normally have tried to do, now a computer is doing.
Yeah, so they can definitely do that as well. AI can be used in different ways, right? This is from a reconnaissance standpoint. Now, from an attack standpoint, it can do some brute force attacking, right? For example, it can understand different passwords that has been inputted before and try a billion other passwords until it can get into an account or something like that. So there is ways to create bots, right, to do manual work automatically. There are ways to do that. AI can use that. There's different ways that you can use LLMs to understand. Like, I can see a use case where it can pull information from someone's profile. Like, you get someone's Facebook profile or Instagram profile and you submit it through an LLM, and somehow, some way, you know, it can generate possible passwords that the user could potentially have, whether it's pulling information from their birthday and they have a pet picture of their pet dog and, you know, put it together, right? And that could be potentially a potential password that they use to try to log into your Facebook account or something like that. So it can be used in that aspect as well.
It kind of makes you feel like, what's the point in even being on the internet, you know?
So here's the thing. At the end of the day, like, this is what I'll tell, like, individual users like me and you from a personal standpoint, not from a company. Companies, it's all about money. You guys have bigger risks, right? We have to take a look at the risks associated to everything. So for the most part, I will be real, like, any PII, personally identifiable information, is already out there, 100%.
So that's social. That's date of birth.
Social.
That's name.
Yeah,
That's
that
mother's
stuff's
maiden name.
already all out there. Yeah,
Okay.
that's on the dark web. People can pull that with from anywhere.
Yeah, what
If
about
you
like
want
banking
to.
passwords?
So that's a different subject. I mean, it depends on the specific bank that or business that you have your passwords registered with, and if they've been previously compromised potentially. And that's why it's so important to have multi-factor authentication on everything you do. And even though you're gonna hate it, it's so important. And even that, like down the road, is slowly being quote unquote compromised. There's ways around it. Like threat actors are finding ways around it. Just make sure you have it. At the very minimum, have it on your phone, like the authenticator app or whatever it is.
It's some good advice.
Avoid email. Avoid email as possible, as much as possible, because like people can spoof emails.
What do you,
you
mean
see,
avoid
you...
email?
So for multi-factor authentication, you can either receive calls or receive an email to receive a token.
Yes.
Or like a five-digit
yes.
five-digit numbers PIN. Avoid those as much as possible, because those can be spoofed as well, and people can potentially, your email address can already be compromised.
Oh,
and the email notification goes to your to the threat actor. So it's important to actually have like an app or a FIDO key, which I don't know if many people actually have that, but more of the cybersecurity people or like more privacy conscious people have a FIDO key to for their second factor of authentication.
FIDO
but,
key.
Yeah. For the most part, if you have your authenticator app, that's the most important. You know, you whether it's Google Authenti or something like that, Duo,
Microsoft
has,
there's tons.
Yeah, there's tons of them. And so, like, as long as you have that and like a push notification type of situation, because that's like registered, the technology behind it, because it's like connected, you have a second factor, like a second form. It's something you have. Something you know is your password, something you have. If there's a way to do biometrics, cool, that works as well. Making sure that you have multi-factor authentication is very, very important to prevent like those passwords being guessed or used on your account, because they only have half of it, right? They don't have the other half. Because something you know, someone can guess what something you know, but they don't have what you have, in a sense, right? They don't have your phone to be able to still log in. So that's from a personal standpoint. From a organizational standpoint, from a risk standpoint, threat actor will more likely try to target an organization because they have more information about people. Rather than targeting individuals, like I mentioned, they're going to get their best bang for their buck. They're going to target organizations with lots of people's information. And then once they compromise that, now they have information about a lot of people that they can use. So they're not going
like to domino.
Yeah, they're not going to, oh, Melissa Parvis. So let me just do a bunch of research on this one specific person, right? No, I don't need to do research on you once I compromise X company that already has all your information and data on it, on you.
So then, okay, does it beg the question of, say, like, they do compromise the information of Fred Jones, who is VP of, I don't know, capital infrastructure projects at massive utility company through some sort of healthcare companies like AT&T, whatever it might be. Could they then use that as reconnaissance to then gain more information about Fred Jones and then use that information to then help them break into the utility?
Yeah, I mean, like everything's to profile people. Everything's to so that's where AI can come in and create profiles of people based off of all their social media, compile everything together, and kind of understand them better.
Oh, that's, yeah, scary. So the more high profile you are, the more at risk you are, basically.
I think you have more eyes on you. You don't want to be have bad publicity, I guess. So,
yeah.
Like, if you do get a compromise, like, if you have some dirt on you, you know, it's not good for your reputation. That's where people can extort you. So, like, people that get extorted are usually high celebrity, high status people, because one, they have money, and two, if dirt gets out on them, they're going to be in some hot water.
Yeah.
But for example, Me or you, right? We're not,
Speak for
we're.
yourself, I'm
All
kidding.
right, for me, like I say, I tell people, like, I'm not important enough. No one cares if my, my phone gets leaked. I don't have anything on there, right? But like, still, if there was anything, no one cares. Like, if for example, LeBron James's like phone gets released and there's a bunch of like pictures on there, like, all right, yeah, people actually do care because of his status, who he is, right? So.
You obviously are in education now, have an educational background in cybersecurity. So I imagine, and also it sounds like from what you've told me, you've always been keeping up with your skills. You've always been, looking into new ideas, new co
I don't know about
me.
that. Sometimes it's hard, but you have to in this industry. Otherwise, you're going to fall behind. The day you stop learning is the day you fall behind. Because threat actors are learning day by day, and everything's advancing so quickly. It's hard for us to stay on top of it. And so, like, we're already behind. Like, right now, we're already like 10 years behind, to be honest.
That's scary. And that was going to be my point is like, I have found as I've gotten older that I've become less neuroplastic. It's become more and more difficult to learn new things and new skills. And it's more and more easy to just kind of like fall back on like what I already know. But it sounds like, if you say graduated with a background in computer science and kind of like started learning a lot about cybersecurity 20 years ago, today, a lot of your knowledge will either be obsolete or like so not relevant to what all of the new things that are coming out that like you kind of got to start from scratch again. Like how can people make sure that they keep up with all of these new threats and as you say, new things that are occurring, AI, all of this new thing that's coming out that's changing the way threat actors operate?
Yeah, to be honest, like that's a great question. Like, I'm still struggling with that. Cuz
Really?
like that's why we have continuing education to keep up our certificates. Like, we have to go out, but like also, we have to go out and learn new things cuz everything's changing so quickly. It's just like having that due diligence of like making sure you do it. All right, that's the hardest part. Just go out and do it. You have to do it. Otherwise, it's going to impact your career. And like, for someone that's actually in a changing industry, like 10 years from now, none of this is gonna matter. There's gonna be so many new threats. There's a lot of foundation behind it. I will say, like, change is pretty hard. So, like, that's why we're still on very old legacy systems, and it costs a lot of money. And so, we never had, like, we're still running on things that's been operating for like 30, 40 years,
I've
and we're
noticed
still
that.
having it. We're still having difficulties moving on from it because, like, if we stop operations on, for example, a specific SCADA system, it's going to pose a negative risk to the health and safety of the public, and that's going to be pretty bad, you know? So, that's why we do have legacy systems, and it's very difficult to move off of them. But the thing is, also, is like there's new r technology that's new threat actors, new cyber tactics, techniques, and procedures that they're developing that we have to keep up with, but we can't necessarily keep up with them because we don't also, there, a knowledge gap starts happening. We don't understand some of this old technology from 40 years ago. The range is so wide that we have to understand. But there's some foundations, but like the foundations are slowly getting updated. Because it's so frequent. Like, for example, there's a lot of like basic item. I'm just gonna go off of like the Windows operating system. Like, the foundations of Windows operating system, like we understand that from like the early 2000s, right? But there's so many new features on there. I'm like, oh, I didn't know that was a brand new feature that I could use or be leveraged for, that could potentially be leveraged for an attack. That's the hard part. I mean, there's some basic foundations that will always be there, but there's just so many new things just adding on, piling up.
So we've talked a lot about some things that I had no idea were that grave and critical. And some of this conversation has been a bit eye-opening and scary to end. Would you say that you would remain scared and concerned? Like, is this a bit worrying? Like, are you worried for the future? How do you feel?
I personally want to run away into a forest, but that's not really something that will be happening. I hate to be pessimistic. There's nothing
No,
we can do about
please.
it. Yeah, there's literally nothing we can do about it. It's happening, whether you like it or not. And we can only do what we can. So from like my perspective, I tried to be as protective and take as much precautions and put as many security controls and make sure that California is in a position to be resilient and fight against and thwart off threat actors and be cyber vigilant. So I'm trying to do my part as much as I can to make sure we're prepared for whenever that incident does happen, because it's not if an incident happens, it's when it's going to happen. Incidences will happen. Cyber attacks will happen whether you like it or not. You have to get over it. Now, the way you prepare for it is that's an important part. So being proactive, having your policy, processes, procedures in place, making sure that your security controls are implemented, that you identify your risks for your business and you kind of prioritize those as well. And understand what's important to your organization and what's mission critical. And like, for example, if an incident does happen, what needs to be the first thing that gets brought back up? And that's based off of your organization's missions, goals, values, whatever that may be. So you have to prepare yourself. That's the most important thing that you can do, because an incident will happen. And then it then comes down to like a risk management situation. It's like, all right, if this goes down, how much am I going to lose? And then in dollar terms, and then how much do I need to invest into this protection to be able to protect this specific critical system or whatever it is, right? So it's all like a cost-benefit analysis, right? If I put in $500,000 to put in a security control that will protect me from a $5 million incident over 4 years, maybe it's worth it. It comes down to a risk management perspective of how you want to address. Because everything has vulnerabilities, everything has risks associated to it.
So thank you so much, Payam. That has been the most interesting thing I've ever heard about cybersecurity. I must admit, I was a little bit worried this was going to be a dry conversation. Absolutely not. It's been verging on terrifying. Speaking of which, if anybody wants some help getting in touch with you, maybe you could help them become more of a vigilant against potential threat actors. I don't, are you interested in anything like that?
Yeah, definitely. I do help out individuals and companies. I do have my consulting firm called Sigarda. More than happy to help out. Melissa will have some of that information, and always feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn. More than happy to just discuss, talk through things, or just, you know, kind of be that extra pair of eyes, like that virtual CISO that you've never had, right? Melissa will have that information for y'all.
Thank you, Payam.
Thank you for listening to Amped Up. If you like this conversation, please support this content. Subscribe and rate the show on YouTube, Apple Podcast, or Spotify.